compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Cyrus, are you going to try that fish and chips recipe that I posted on Twitter? I think it's easy to make.
Yeah, I've been trying that my whole life.
Yeah. Oh, so you already knew about that recipe.
I didn't know. Never thought to call it fish and chips, but yeah.
Look at it.
Delicious.
See? It beats Doritos any day, if you ask me. Welcome back, everybody. 888-914-9149 is the number. We want to get to a little more audio, then we're going to come back to the phone calls. So let's fire up the audios now. We've got another one. Now, this one is going to take a little more time. Do we want to do the 20-year-old discovery, Cyrus, or do we want to do the more serious one about the lady who's saying some racist things?
Yeah,
what's your call?
Let's start with the longer one and get that out of the way.
Okay.
This is good.
Yeah, and I have a heavy heart when I play stuff like this, but the thing I've been saying is that, how can I put this? I've been thinking about this. We live in a time now, and probably other generations have gone through something similar. I don't know, but we live in a time now where people are so at each other's throats and so quick to be offended and angry and retaliate and all that. Now, this is set within the context of racism, which is obviously no joking matter. This is a very serious and terrible situation. I want to begin by as strongly, as adamantly, as forcefully, as vigorously, as clearly as I can to denounce not only racism, but any vestige of white supremacy or white people in any way looking down or being racist toward anyone else, whether it's black people, Asians, Hispanics, what have you, whatever it may be. Racism is wrong. It's evil. And this country has a long history of problems with racism. Let's just say it as it is. The Jim Crow laws that were only even really finally sort of exterminated in the 1950s and into the 60s. I myself, as a child, I saw maybe one of the last few traces of Jim Crow laws in the mid-60s. I was on a driving trip with an aunt and uncle. We were down in the Deep South, and I saw a sign that said, "Whites only." I think it was at the bathroom or something. And I asked my uncle, I said, "What's that?" And he explained it to me. He says, "Well, it's a bad law where white people were allowed to use this bathroom and black people were not allowed to use it. They had to have a separate bathroom." And it didn't make any sense to me. It's like, well, why would they do that? Just as a child, it just made no sense to me whatsoever. So I got the child's version explanation from him. And as I grew older and I learned about the problems with racism and, of course, the Civil War as a means of trying to put an end to the peculiar institution of slavery, and then learning about how many people in this country, they thought that not only slavery was okay, they even defended it using the Bible very often. So growing up and learning and studying about the terrible aspect of slavery in this country and all the harms and all the problems that it has engendered since that time, you know, I think any normal person who has a heart, who has compassion, is going to look at that and bemoan it and rue the fact that we have, as a people, we have as a country, this terrible dark chapter that we have to deal with, and the aftermath as well. So I want to be, again, as vigorous as I can be in denouncing racism of any kind, and in particular, denouncing white supremacy, the KKK, skinheads, you know, all of that. I absolutely 100% denounce it. And I'm sure all of you do too. But what I also denounce is racism as such. It's not as though racism is wrong if a certain group of people does it, but it's not wrong if another group of people does it. And your skin color has nothing to do with it one way or the other. So I want you to listen to I call it a rant. It's really just an interview. It's a college professor. I don't know her name. I wasn't able to locate her name this morning, but it's part of an interview that she did in which she's She's basically saying the opposite of what I'm telling you. In the name of ostensibly trying to be an anti-racist, she is just spouting racism. Now, she's African-American. She's talking about white people. And if you are white, she's talking about you. And I will set this up simply by saying, as we go along, and I'll pause this every so often and I'll offer a few comments. I'd be very interested in knowing what you think about it. The number is 888-914-9149. You're welcome to call in and share your thoughts on what you're going to hear right now. It's only a few minutes long, but it's important to listen to because these people are in positions of power. And when I say these people, I'm not referring to skin color here. I'm referring to ideologies, the ideologues among us who spout this kind of nonsense that you're about to hear of whatever color, white, black, indifferent, doesn't matter. Our educational system is riddled with people who think like this lady does. So as we listen, what I would like you to do, just do a thought experiment. When she's referring to whites or white people or white folks or whiteness or any of the ways in which she says it, just imagine if the word, I don't know, Mexican was there. And Mexican is not a race, obviously. Or imagine that the word black is there. Imagine if somebody said the same exact thing, but substitute white for a different racial group. And I think you'll get the idea of what I'm saying. So we're just going to let her speak for herself. And here and there, I'll pop in with a comment. Let's go.
The real sort of issue here, and I've heard people sort of say it, is one, I think that white people viscerally fear. It's not that white people don't know, right, what they have done. They know. They fear that there is no other way to be human but the way in which they are human, which is to, so, you know, like you talk to white people and whenever you really want to have a reckoning about it, they say stuff like, you know, it's just human nature. If y'all had all of this power, you would have done the same thing, right? And it's like, no, that's what white humans did. White human beings thought there's a world here and we own it. Prior to them, black and brown people have been sailing across oceans, interacting with each other for centuries without total subjugation, domination, and colonialism. We have seen
what a show. Okay. We're going to hear all of it, but there are a few little juicy bits here I want to talk about. I don't know what discipline this woman teaches in. I hope it's not history, because if it's history, she's woefully ignorant about the history not only of Africa, but also of what we consider the United States now, the New World. And she's right, of course, that there were countless people here who were living, living and interacting with each other. But if she has this idea, apparently she does, that the problems only really started when the white Europeans showed up, she's got it completely wrong. If you study the history of the native tribes in this country, you will find slavery. You will find capital punishment. You will find ritual torture. You will find human sacrifice. You will find, to the nth degree, the horrors, not all of which, by the way, were practiced in Europe. Even the European explorers were horrified and taken aback by the savagery and the savage violence, I should say, that was perpetrated by tribes against each other. And even the Europeans didn't do some of the things that they found going on here. So it was a violent, rapacious culture that they found here. It had many good points, no doubt about that. It wasn't entirely bad by any stretch. So there were many good and wonderful things that they discovered when they came here among the people. But it's not as she's portraying it. It's not as though there was this sort of idyllic Disneyland where the black and brown people all got along famously and everybody was just happy. And when those terrible Europeans showed up, suddenly all the problems started. It's not like that at all. So that's one thing. The second thing is, she is correct that when the Europeans showed up, they did very often, and for the most part at least, they did enslave the native peoples who were here. They did exploit them. They did kill them. They did terrible things to them. And we should never, not only never forget that, but we should never try to sweep it under the rug or pretend it didn't happen. You know, even Christopher Columbus, by his own notes, you know, his own diary, in his own words, he records for posterity some of the terrible things that he was involved with when he was here. So that has to be said as well. There must be a clear an accurate accounting of the historical facts, not this fantasy world that this woman is painting. And I think her gullible and ignorant listeners won't know any better, and so they'll just assume that what she's saying is true. Let's continue.
Because they cannot imagine that there's another way to be. It is either that you dominate or you are dominated. And isn't it sad that that is spiritually who they are, and that they can't imagine a sort of more expansive notion of the world? The thing I want to say to you is we got to take this out. But I know, but like, we can't say that, right? We can't say, like, I don't believe in a project of violence. I truly don't. Because I think in the end that our souls suffer from that. And I do think that some of this is a spiritual condition. So here is where I land most days about white people. And I actually have been helped in this by thinking about indigenous people, right? See, part of the challenge around whiteness is that it totally skews our view of everything, right? I gave this like TED talk about this some years back, and one of the reasons I was trying to think about it is like the world didn't start when white people arrived in America and tried to tell all the rest of us how things were going to go. There were people out here making worlds, Africans and indigenous people being brilliant and, you know, libraries and inventions and, you know, vibrant notions of humanity and cross-cultural exchange long before white people showed up being.
Let's pause. Okay, well, a few other historical problems here. Number one, her whole premise is based upon an historical fact that white people were the ones who brought the Africans here to the New World, as we'll call it, as slaves. And that, of course, is true. That did happen. They weren't here prior to that time. They were not building libraries in pre-Columbian North or Central America. There were no libraries. Many of the folk, most of the folk, did not even have written languages. So this nonsensical motif that she's promoting here, that the black and the brown people were just living together in harmony, peace, love, and Bobby Sherman, he's white, so we won't count him, but peace and love, and building libraries, and being brilliant, and having a great old time, this is simply not true. But again, gullible and ignorant people are going to listen to that and say, yeah, that's right. Now, again, you notice that we have to take stock of what really happened, and insofar as the things that really happened were evil, and racism is evil, and enslaving people is evil, and exploiting people is evil. All those things, white supremacy, they are evil. But white supremacy, as evil as it is no more or less evil than any other racial group asserting its own superiority over other racial groups. If it's racism, and racism is evil, then it doesn't matter who is practicing racism or what that person's skin color is, it's still racism. It's still wrong. And that's why it has to be opposed. And that's why people like this lady, you need to hear what she's saying as part of the solution to defusing the kind of problems that she is perpetrating, all in the name of being anti-racist. Let's continue.
Long before white people showed up being raggedy and violent and terrible and trying to take everything from everybody. And that's really important, because if we believe that history starts for us when white people drag us to these shores, then we can never get outside of the notion that this is going to be our existential struggle. All things that begin end. White folks are not infinite and eternal. Right? They ain't gonna go on for infinity and infinity. And that's super important to remember, that white colonialism and imperialism has a beginning. And in my way of thinking about the world, that means it has an end. And so part of what we are trying to do is to imagine what are the steps that we must take to get to the other side of this very inconvenient, you know, epochal interruption of like black and indigenous world making. I mean, does that give people comfort on a day-to-day when you like just having to deal with white folks and the travesties that they create and the sense that they want to destroy the planet? Nah, there is a world beyond even our sojourn on the earth. And so whiteness is going to have an end date, because it is not, despite what white people think of themselves, they do not defy the laws of eternity, right? Their projects are not so sophisticated that the natural laws of physics change for them. And when we sort of humble them in the, in humble our own understandings of whiteness. It seems like the biggest giant that we face, but in the end, right, it is what I like to say is, you know, Black folks were out here for centuries and centuries and millennia doing all kinds of wonderful things. Whiteness is largely an inconvenient interruption. And so we then get to ask ourselves, so why am I here in this moment of it? Like, you know, why did I show up in this particular iteration? And it's like, well, I think we showed up in this iteration precisely so that we could help to figure out an end and a way to the other side of this, you know, gargantuan historical tragedy that is white supremacy.
Okay. So you've heard my take on this. That is racist. What she's saying is racist. It's racism. And racism is always evil. And saying that does not in any way diminish the horrors of slavery and the horrors of white supremacy and Jim Crow and the other things that have happened, terrible things that we have to acknowledge and study so that we don't have them happen again. But this is another way of it starting to happen again, in my view at least, when people wrap themselves in the mantle of being anti-racist, so-called, but the tool of choice for them is their own version of racism. So I'll leave it at that, but I'd like to hear what you think. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Tom in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, everyone. I wish I was a little bit more eloquent, but I'll do my best. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in West Africa in a country called Mauritania. And what I understand that most people in this country don't know where Mauritania is. But one of the things that I like to talk about is that Mauritania abolished slavery only in the year 2007. So that's not 1907, in the year 2007. So right. I was there from 2002 to 2003. And one of my colleagues lived with a Mauritanian family, and that family had a slave. It was a young girl who lived under the stairs, and she did cleaning and cooking tasks for them, and she was no relation of them. So I just want to say that racism and slavery and all of the injustices that happen in the world, that's not a uniquely American thing, and I think that many people in this country think that.
Yeah, and let me add to that, Vince. Now, I did not know what you just said about Mauritania. That's an interesting historical detail. And how amazing and strange it is that that country would still be permitted, you know, just without the negative social pressure, but be permitted to have slavery as a law. But going back to the time of the beginning of the slave trade, you know, way long ago, the Europeans who went to Africa to get the slaves bought the slaves from other Africans, other black Africans who owned slaves. So the beginning of the white slave trade in what is now the United States, etc., it began by purchasing slaves from slave owners who were black in Africa, which adds to what you're referring to.
That's correct. My one first degree is in history. From what I understand, the name like of the Slavic people in Eastern Europe, that's a variation off of the word slave, and that's because the Turks who lived in or who became the Ottoman Turks, that's where they got their people from too. So, of course, and then of course the Hebrews were slaves of the Egyptians. So there's a long history of unfortunate acts throughout the whole world by one group of people against another, just based off of fear or opportunity.
Yeah, it's the history of humanity is littered with slavery. Everywhere you go, you find it everywhere. So I agree with your point. It's a good one, Tom. And that's why the lady that we just heard from a moment ago is so pernicious. Her message is pernicious because it preys upon the ignorance of people who don't realize, or at least they've never studied enough to realize, that every culture everywhere in its own way has practiced slavery. And it's not simply a white problem. And to say that it is completely not only misunderstands history or is ignorant of history, but also it's a way of reinforcing racism under the guise of being anti-racist. I appreciate the call, Tom. Thank you. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Maddie. We're going to change the topic for a minute. Maddie in Burnsville, Minnesota. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Majesty, Patrick Madrid.
Thank you. You're exempt from that rule. Only Cyrus is required to follow it.
Oh, okay. I have a question for you regarding the anointing of the sick.
Yes.
And maybe I can explain the situation and then wait for your answer.
Sure.
So we have a new priest to our parish who we love, and he has been traveling. Anyways, he's here off and on, and then on we're working on welcoming him into our parish formally. And the Saturday night vigil mass, it was set up ahead of time that they would do an anointing of the sick after the mass. That's fine. Our parish is, there's two parishes near that have schools attached, so a lot of our parish are silver hairs and probably have some health things going on. Mm-hmm. So we did not attend Saturday. We attended Sunday. And after the mass was over, he kind of explained before the final song and the dismissal that at the vigil mass he had done an anointing of the sick, and that he would like to do that for anyone that was feeling that they needed that sacrament. He explained where he would put the oil. He explained the
right. The details are interesting, but I'm sure you have a specific question you wanted to ask, Maddie. What is that?
Yes. So he is that okay for him to do?
No.
Just no.
No.
Okay.
No.
And
yeah, this and is a
to,
widely.
To,
mm-hmm. I'll just say this real quick. This is a widely misunderstood sacrament. The Catechism of the Catholic Church is really clear. It says the anointing of the sick is not a sacrament for those only who are at the point of death. Hence, as soon as anyone of the faithful begins to be in danger of death from sickness or old age, the fitting time for him to receive the sacrament has certainly already arrived. So, if it's an indiscriminate giving of the sacrament of the anointing of the sick to anybody who's just not feeling well, whether they're old or not, that's wrong. That's a misuse of the sacrament. It's for those who are, have reached the point, as it says here, as soon as any one of the faithful, anyone, doesn't matter your age, as soon as anyone has begun to be in danger of death from sickness or old age, then it's a fitting time. So old people who are in danger of death because by their advanced age, they're getting near to the time where they're going to die, it is a proper time for them to receive it. And they don't have to be sick to receive that sacrament. But it's also for people of any age who are in danger of death because of an illness. So let's say a child can receive the sacrament if the child is in danger of death. But all the rest of us who are neither sick to the point of being in danger of death or not of an advanced age are not the right candidates for this sacrament. And so I've seen this done before where the priest will say, okay, anybody, you know, if you're not feeling well or if you just would like to get the sacrament, come on up. That's not the way the sacrament is supposed to be administered.
There is one more detail.
All right.
The next day, our priest was riding his bike as he loves to do and was tragically killed. Hit by a car and killed.
Terrible.
Terrible. So for those people that had that anointing, it's been a very positive memory for them now looking back.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think, I mean, he felt the spirit move, that he was reaching out to these people in his new community? I don't know.
I'm sure he was, may he rest in peace. I'm sure he was doing it as he was trying to be pastoral. He was trying to be loving and help people. I never met him, but I would not doubt that he had all of those intentions. And those are good. But at the same time, somebody can have the best of intentions and still do something that's not quite right. And so I don't attribute any malice to him or anything like that whatsoever. But since you're asking me, was it okay for that to happen? I'm just trying to share with you what the church says about that sacrament. You know, it's not intended.
Got it.
You know, okay, I guess I'd be repeating myself at that point, but, you know.
Got it.
I can imagine how that incident would have caused people to be all the more, you know, missing him and praying for him, which is a good thing. Hey, Maddie, thank you. I have to take a quick time out. I think that's what we're doing. And then I'll be right back right after this. This is the Patrick Madrid Show. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
All right, we are back. You're listening to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Thank you for listening. Let's go to Diane now, listening in Bloomington, Minnesota. Good morning, Diane.
Thank you. I just want to say before my question is my husband and I love you, and you have such a way about you know how to handle people. Just a quick side note, the lady about you and her differed, she should go back and listen to a rerun of that. And so then I would clarify it for her.
Well, thank you.
Anyhow, that's your job. We love you. And another side note is that I promote Relevant Radio, and you in particular.
Thank you.
Everywhere. At the airport, on the phone.
Thank you.
In text, in email. And so, anyhow, my question was that
thank you.
A while ago you had put on the air a priest, and I think it was New Mexico, that spoke from the in front of the church. What's it called? Not the podium, the
ambo, the pulpit.
Ambo, yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. About abortion, and he really struck home right directly to the people, his church people. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, do you have any name of the priest, church that he did this at? Do you have anything where I could find the connection to listen to that again? You aired part of it.
Yeah, I can tell you exactly who it was. It was Father John Lankett, Lankeit. He's a priest of the Diocese of Phoenix. And
I'm sorry. You know what? I'm so unprepared. Let me write this down. Okay. I've got something to write on. John?
Father John Lankett.
L-A-N...
K-E-I-T.
L-A-N-K-E-I-T.
So it rhymes with blanket. And he's a priest of the Diocese of Phoenix. So if you go on YouTube, you can just type in his name, Father John Lankett, abortion, or just Father John Lankett, and you'll find a number of his sermons. I think we've played a total of two over the years. And he'd be very easy to find, and you'd be able to get his sermons in their entirety.
Parish name?
I have
a vision impairment, so I'm a progressive eye disease called retinitis pigmentosa, so I'm going to go blind. If you could pray that also, if your people, your listeners, and you could pray for me, that's great. So it takes me longer to write anything down.
Sure.
Father John, and can you spell that last name again?
Lankeit. Lankeit. Father John Lankett. And I'm sure he will be exactly what you're remembering. He's a very good preacher, very effective, and I was pleased to be able to play a couple of those sermons on the show. Thank you, Yvonne, and we certainly will pray for you, absolutely. Let's go to Steve now in Michigan. Good morning, Steve.
Hey, good morning, Patrick, and thank you for all that you guys do, and a blessed belated birthday to Cyrus. Sorry, no blankets to send to him or anything. I should have someone make a quilt or something. On the topic of ethnic justice and history in the United States, I'm just not sure if you ever heard of Robert L. Woodson Sr., I think. Anyway, he has a website that just does a great job at counterbalancing things like the 1619 Project with a lot of just truth. He's just a scholar and a gentleman, literally, from what I've learned about him. And they have a website called 1776unites.com, I think it is. And it's just awesome. It's just it's primarily African-Americans themselves and just intellectuals. And they just really tell the truth, I've found, factually. And just, you know, they actually know what they're talking about. And they have a hope-filled vision of the future. And they're not just into looking at past grievances and and they just see a future for America. So I just wanted to, mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you ever heard of that website, but I had not heard of it,
but I pulled it up and as you were talking, and yep. I can see the faces of some of the people involved. Most of them, with maybe one or two exceptions, are African American, and they all appear to be scholars, at least from what I can see. Well, thank you for letting me know about that.
Thank you, Patrick. God bless you guys.
Thank you. And Cyrus, anything you want to say? No blanket this time, but...
Thanks, Steve.
You sound so excited, Cyrus.
And no tacos for Patrick, sorry.
That's true. Well, can't win everything, can you? Yeah, thank you. 888-914-9149. We'll go now to Deacon Martin in Gary, Indiana. Hello, Deacon Martin.
Good morning. In comment about slavery out of Africa, most people don't realize that the slave trade went east before it went west. And around the 800s, the Muslims started moving Africans east into Asia as slaves. And that slave trade still exists. Today, we just happen to call it human trafficking. Then the slave trade came to the Americas. When it came to the Americas, it came in the 15th century. I'm sorry. So it's not. Sometimes it's just that people don't really understand the entirety of the slave trade. And it's the African diaspora is spread all over the world. We're the largest diaspora spread all over the world. And people don't realize that when the Muslims started selling Africans, and Africans were selling Africans, and everybody was selling Africans.
Well, you know, you're correct on that point, of course, but it long predates the rise of Islam. So there were African slaves in Rome before the time of Jesus, and slavery of all kinds of people, not just Africans, but they certainly were present there. So,
when you look at the history, I mean, you can go back and say, okay, at the beginning of time there were slaves. That's true, but there's a very distinct point at which Muslims start selling people in India and China, and that's kind of what's considered at the beginning of the African slave trade. I mean, there's always the spoils of war, because that's always going on. Mm-hmm. But in general, the trade, I mean, people have always enslaved one another,
right?
So we're not going to get around that. And people have always said chattel slavery. It may have been, you can argue that maybe it was more brutal in America than it was in other parts of the world, but it doesn't mean, if somebody owns you and possesses you, it doesn't really change anything. I mean, that's the story of St. Josephine Baquita. Mm-hmm. That's what she fought for. You know, I mean, so, and I mean, she died in 1947, within the lifetime of many of your listeners. So when people start talking about, you know, things and they want to limit it, that's the problem. You have to look at, you know, cause I do presentations on African saints. Mm-hmm. And, you know, African saints go back to the beginning of the church. We've had three popes and six doctors. You know, so you start talking about that and people say, I never heard that. Because you never heard it doesn't mean it didn't exist. And
I don't argue with that.
Not part of our history, part of our culture. I mean, it's even like, you know, when people talk about Mexicans, you're talking about a blend of the indigenous Aztecs and other people that were there, and Spanish that came over. And so it's,
being Mexican myself on my father's side, I know exactly what you're referring to, the mixing of the cultures. Well, that's all interesting stuff, Deacon Mexican. Martin.
All right, Patrick, thank you. Take care. God bless you, Nancy.
Always good to hear from you. Thank you. God bless you, too. Let's see. Okay, Cyrus, do you want to do the story now before we go to another phone call? Do you want to do that story?
Yeah, let's do that story.
Let's do it. Okay. So let me get my paper.
Did you ever stick anything up your nose when you were a kid?
I don't recall ever doing that, but I do remember... Well, let me tell the story. Let's do the story, okay? And then I'll fess up. So here it is. New York Post. A Georgia woman, and we have audio of her talking, don't we, Cyrus?
I do.
Or do we?
Yeah, I do. But
do you want to just play the audio, or do you want me to fill in the...
Why don't you do most of it, and then she can come in and do the very last
bit. She can fill in the blanks, fill in the gaps, okay, as it were. All right, here we go. So this lady in Georgia, she had what she thought, and the word that she uses is booger. Sorry, that's the word she uses. I grew up calling it moco. That's what we called it in my family. It was a moco. Anyway, so she thought she had a big, in her word, booger up in her nose.
When you sent me the story, I was like, is he really going to do this on air?
Is he really going to do this? Hey, he's really doing
it. He's doing it. Here we go.
So let me, so here's the thing. So she's trying to get this thing out, and she discovers that this is a little blue plastic bead that she had gotten lodged up in a childhood bead accident, and it got lodged in her sinus, and it was up there for 20 years. Her name's Hannah Hamilton, 23 years old. This is her claim to fame now. Everybody knows about Hannah Hamilton, God bless her, because she thought she was getting one of those big green things out of her nose, and it turns out it was a bead that has been up there for 20 years. 20 years. How do you not know it's in there?
Apparently, it's pretty painful, as you might imagine.
If you could go 20 years and not notice it, it couldn't have been that painful. She says, I don't remember much about that time, but my mom was very into arts and crafts, so we always had beads, glitter, etc. around the house. The memory I had is of me standing in front of the linen closet in the kids' bathroom and pulling the bead out of a basket in the closet. Well, we'll let her tell it herself. Here she is.
You know those memories you have from being really little, like 3 to 5 years old, that you don't know if they're real or they're something you saw on a TV show or that your parents told you or something like that, so you're not really sure if they're real, but you remember them? Well, when I was like 3, I remember sticking a bead up my nose and being like, it's not coming out. I didn't tell anyone, I don't know why, but I didn't tell anyone that I stuck this bead up my nose and forgot about it. This is probably TMI, but I had a sinus infection a couple weeks ago, and I had this massive booger. I could not get out. It was like right up here, and it would not come out. It was super painful, and it was bothering me. So I got one of those earwax cleaning cameras. I know you're not supposed to use them anywhere else, but I used it in my nose to see if I could see this, and it was just big, and I couldn't get it out.
All right, I'm going to spare everybody. I'm going to spare everybody, and we're going to jump. We're going to jump.
Please jump now.
Okay.
Well, I finally got it out. It was very painful. But a bead, a blue bead that has been in my nose for 20 years, just came out of my nose. 20 years I've been living with the bead inside my nose, and I had no idea.
Where are we doing this story? I'm trying to refresh my memory. What was it about this story other than the shock value?
Where's the God door?
I don't think there
is. On this one.
Okay, let's find a God door. Okay, how about this? And I know we have to take a break. There may be. It's hard to find a God door. Okay, how about this? Maybe you committed a sin a long time ago, and you never confessed it, and it's still in there because you haven't confessed it. So you can go to confession and get it all taken care of, and you no longer have that sin on your soul. That's a fairly plausible God door, I would think.
I didn't think you'd be able to do it, and I'm wrong. Wow, nicely done.
Yeah. So on that note, we will take a break. We are coming right back right after this, though. 888-914-9149. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and RelevantRadio.com. Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now.
All right. To the phones. Let's go to Joseph in Moraga, California. Good morning, Joseph.
Thank you for doing this show. I have a question about, will Jesus eventually come back to Earth again?
Yes, he will. He will return, as he says, with a cry. St. Paul talks about it as a shout of an archangel, the blast of a trumpet, and he will return in glory, coming upon the clouds. He talks about this himself in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 25. You know the story about the sheep and the goats, how Jesus talks about at the end of the world, he'll judge people and you'll be in one group or the other, the sheep or the goats. Remember that one?
No, I don't. I don't think I recall that one.
Okay. Well, it's a really good teaching. I mean, all of his teachings are good, obviously, but this is a really vivid teaching where he talks about how at the end he will return to judge the nations and all the people who... He gives an example to the sheep. He says, when I was hungry, you fed me. When I was thirsty, you gave me to drink. When I was naked, you clothed me, etc. And they'll say, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or naked? And he said, I assure you that when you did it for the least of these, you did it for me. And then he turns to the goats and he says, when I was hungry, you didn't feed me. And when I was thirsty, you didn't give me to drink. So he goes through the same thing, but it's in reverse. Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty, etc.? He says, I tell you, because you didn't do it to the least of these, you didn't do it to me. And he describes how the goats are sent off into eternal fire of hell, and the sheep are sent to heaven. So he's using this analogy between sheep and goats, not as real animals, but as a way to describe the good and the bad at the end. So in that passage, in that chapter, rather, is where he describes how he will return. And that will be at the end of the world.
Okay. Will he come physically or will he come like spiritually?
He will be physical because Jesus has a glorified body. So he will be present in a way similar to how he was present to the apostles. But he will be in glory. So when he was with the apostles for 40 days after the resurrection, he was in a glorified body. So he could pass through walls, but he could still eat and speak to them and touch them, and they could touch him. So he will he will have his body. I mean, it'll never be separated from him, but he will be glorified. I mean, he's glorified now, but we will see him in his glory when he comes back to earth. Won't that be amazing?
Yeah, it will.
I'm guessing you're probably in high school. Is that right?
No, I'm actually in eighth grade.
Are you? We sound very mature. So did we get
to the
heart of your question, or did you have anything else?
Yeah, you answered my question. Thank you, and God bless you. Bye.
You're welcome, Joseph. Good to chat with you. Fine young man. 888-914-9149. Cyrus, do you remember when you were in the eighth grade? Were you thinking deep thoughts like that when you were in the eighth grade?
No. No, I was not. Let's just leave it at
that. You were playing with... Not Pogs, because they probably didn't have Pogs when you were in eighth grade. What did they have when you were in eighth grade?
I had video games. I had NBA Live 95.
Yeah. And, video poker?
And all the time. Nope. Just this NBA game that I... And,
was this a
and
handheld?
Tecmo Bowl. And Tecmo Bowl. I played a
was
lot.
Was it a handheld video game?
Yeah, like the home. The home.
Oh, like Atari. That
like
kind
Atari.
Of thing?
Yeah, like okay. Atari.
Why are you laughing?
You just dated yourself.
Oh, right. So Ataris came out when you were older? Or?
Ataris came out when I was like a baby.
Oh.
And the
what a baby.
And then the Nintendo. And then so by the time, so eighth grade, I was playing Genesis, Sega Genesis.
The first game I ever played on an Atari, it was enthralling. I have to tell you, it was enthralling. It was called Pong. And there's a white... like a white oblong thing on the bottom of the screen and a white oblong thing on the top of the screen and a white dot, and you would just simply bounce it back and forth, top to bottom.
Hey, it was simple. Pong was fun.
It was fun.
But Pac-Man.
And then there was Breakthrough. Did you ever see Breakthrough? Where you'd have to move the oblong piece to knock the ball to break out the bricks.
And the ball was actually a square?
I guess, yeah.
I remember that. And then Pac-Man came along and changed the world.
It sure did. I was working in retail. And, I remember when the Pac-Man games hit. People were in a frenzy for that. Absolute frenzy. Speaking of which, let's get back to our frenzy of phone calls. Let's go to Mark in Arcata, California. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Patrick. I had two questions, but one I told your call screener. Maybe if we have enough time, you can take the second question. A youngster called yesterday and asked you why God created the devil. And your answer said something like, well, he has free will. I mean, referring to why is the devil, why did he create evil, an evil devil? And I thought that contrasted with what you said about angels before, when you said they were born with everything they know, and I thought you said they didn't have that kind of free will, and they can't change, which is why the devil would never be forgiven.
I see the dilemma. Okay. Thanks for raising that, Mark. Well, I'll put it this way. The angels they have a different kind of intellect than we do. And in the case of the angels, and I'll go with St. Thomas as an authority on this issue, he says that the angels, their intelligence is not deductive. They don't arrive at conclusions the way we do, where we have to reason our way toward the truth. The angels are given to know things immediately and entirely. So whatever it is that they're given by God to know, they know it all comprehensively. In the case of my answer to the little girl, I think it was yesterday, the angels were given a test, and maybe you already know all this, but just to try to rehearse it so we can resolve this dilemma. The angels were given a test by God. St. Thomas says immediately after they were created. So it wasn't as though they were floating around for a while, and then God says, hey, guys, I got a test for you. They were given this test immediately after they were created, St. Thomas says, and the test, whatever it was passed. Some angels passed it, majority, it seems, did. The minority failed it, and they turned against God. And in so doing, they changed from being good angels to being demons. And so they were disfigured, if we can use that term. They don't have bodies, but they were disfigured and made ugly and debased. And so her question, as I understood it, was, why did God make the devil? And I understood her to be thinking that he made him as a devil. So my point in that area was to say God did not make them as devils. God made them all as good angels, but they became bad because they used their free will, which God gave them, to choose against God. Because that's the first part of my answer. Second part of my answer would be that angels do indeed have free will as manifested by their decision to choose for or against God. But as St. Thomas teaches, when they made their decision, then it became permanent. It became irrevocable. It doesn't mean that they no longer have free will, but their free will is decisively choosing either for or against God. So they're confirmed in their decision, and it's irrevocable. And we can say the same about, say, the Blessed Virgin Mary or all the saints in heaven. They too have free will, but their free will is now so unalterably fixed toward God that, not that they can't choose for themselves, but they've made their decision, and their decision is now permanent. So the angels and the way that they know things is not really in conflict with the fact that they made this decision because of the permanent nature of that, if that makes sense. Does that clarify it a little bit better?
Sure. I know, not, you know, makes as much sense as anything else. I thought Origins Universalist Church was a, you know, maybe St. Thomas disagreed with Origen, but, you know, that was so long ago that...
Yeah, Origen was a brilliant man, but he also made a few theological errors, and I suppose if he hadn't done those things, he would have been considered one of the fathers of the church in an official sense. But his writings are nonetheless very important, but we just have to recognize that he had a few missteps here and there. Well, I'm glad I could help with the angel question.
Okay. The other question was confession. If someone confessed a crime, like they knocked over a bank, can the priest order a penance that say, okay, you got to say 100 Hail Marys, and by the way, you got to turn yourself in?
The priest can certainly say that, but that is not... integral to making a good confession. So let's put it this way, if the priest had reason to believe that the penitent wasn't really sorry you know, that he didn't, like, he got away. Okay, I got away. Phew. And he wasn't really sorry. The priest could deny him absolution. But the priest cannot, strictly speaking, require him to turn himself in as a condition for absolution. He can strongly encourage it. He can urge the man to do that. But he couldn't, on that ground only, withhold absolution if all other indications were that the man was sorry for his sins.
If the man was truly sorry, then...
He could give him absolution, right? But he couldn't make it a requirement. He couldn't make turning himself in a requirement for absolution.
Okay.
I got to run.
And
don't rob any banks, Mark. Not that you would. I'll be right back. We have a whole other hour right after this quick timeout, so please stay right there.